beginning of wisdom and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. So says the book of Proverbs. But perhaps after having looked in detail at the story of the flood over the past few weeks, maybe you were wishing you understood a little less about the Holy One than when we started this series. Far from being the beginning of wisdom, the fear of the Lord that might be produced by properly understanding our position as sinners in the hands of an angry God is more like the fear a child might have of a rabid dog that lives down the street. You know, you wake up in the night hearing its bark. You struggle to think about anything else. You'll walk the long way back from school just so you don't have to go past that house. You know, go past that fence that barely seems to keep this monster contained. Now, at some level, I think almost all of us here want to know God better. Why else would we bother coming to church? But we should all understand at this point that we're sinners. We might be good people, but we're not perfect people. And we should understand that the tiniest blot on our character will be detestable to God. We get, I think, that God is glorious and desirable. We should want, above anything, to be with Him, to spend time with Him, to be known by Him. But has our fear for Him turned from awe, from reverence, to terror? Do we live in constant anxiety that He might, without a moment's notice, turn on us like a wild animal? Is our coming to church, our prayer, our giving, all just a way of trying to do the bare minimum to not draw attention to ourselves? Putting our heads down, hands in our pockets, and walking past that barking dog as quickly as we can. I'm sure all these thoughts and more were in Noah's head when he and his family and all the animals got off the ark. Now surely Noah is the kind of man who is more than aware of his unworthiness, hyper-conscious of his sin. And he's just, by the grace of God, contrary to what he actually deserved, survived the outpouring of God's anger against human wickedness, a wickedness from which he isn't immune. What guarantee does Noah have that God won't turn on him? What guarantee does the earth have that God won't get rid of man's sins once and for all by sending a second flood? It's to destroy this uncertainty that God makes a covenant with Noah. A divinely given arrangement by which the earth might be blessed. A solemn and binding agreement that will demonstrate more of his character than the flood ever did. That will show the fearful sinner just how they can hope to delight in a holy God. We're going to look at the three main components of this covenant: the promise, stipulations, and sign. Now these are the three parts of pretty much every covenant in the Bible. If you can get this down, if you've got your own Bible, feel free to write it in the front. It will help you understand everyone, whether it's a covenant between men and women or between God and man. Those that bear a resemblance to each other and yet are categorically different from each other. Now we'll start by looking at this promise that God makes. And we haven't more time to dwell on it this morning, but it's worth noting that this covenant promise is made in response to Noah's sacrificial worship at the end of chapter 8. That's why we read those verses. The soothing fragrance, there's another clever play on words there between Noah's name and the word for soothing or calming. The soothing fragrance of Noah's worship rises to heaven, and God commits in his heart. So you've got the contrast between what's in God's heart and what's in man's heart. He commits to never again curse the ground. Now this promise is multifaceted. It's not meant to be some contract that he can welch out of. It's not meant to allow for loopholes that can prove it to have been as worthless as the paper it wasn't written on. This is a solid and binding commitment that God makes with himself, despite the evil of human hearts. As long as the world continues, God will never again wipe us all out. Seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. No ifs, no buts. Natural cycles will continue without the disruption of God's universal judgment. Now this doesn't promise, by the way, a world without drought or famine or death or disease. The curse from chapter 3 still stands. What food man has, he has to get by the sweat of his brow. The world is still fallen. It's still imperfect. But even though man's heart is desperately wicked, God won't ever again flood the earth. Now that is a guarantee that we can make despite the best efforts of Storm Kira, is it, to wipe away some of our roof tiles and trees. Now, far from cursing man, God blesses him. He repeats the command given to Adam and Eve to be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth, right at the start of chapter 9 there. To make this possible, that they will be able to increase, that they'll be able to reproduce and fill the earth, he promises that the animals, and it seems in some ways that after the fall, there is potentially rebellious against man, as man is against God. But he promises that the animals are put under man's dominion again. They're now given to the man to eat. Now all this, by the way, shows the continuity and discontinuity that I mentioned last week between creation before the flood and after the flood. If you want long fancy words, it's pre-diluvian and antediluvian and post-diluvian. Oh. Anyway, worry about that later. When God created the world, Adam and Eve were king and queen over the animal creation. I don't know if you remember that. When God brought the animals to Adam to see what he would name them, as the first man exercising his rule, he gave them a name, he gave them their character. What they were to be was determined by Adam's command. Now, no doubt, before the fall, man could give commandments, orders, to animals, and the animals would have obeyed. Now, even last week, we saw in verse 9, the apparent tenderness, if you want to look back over the page, with which Noah received the dove when it came back to the ark, and you know, he puts his hand out, the dove comes and he takes it back into the ark. Now though, there's been a change in that relationship. It's no longer mutually joyful. The animals don't willingly submit to man, they're afraid of him. The way that subjects would be frightened of a tyrant. Given the right circumstances, even a well-trained dog can bite its owner. Now, God's promise is a wonderful protection for man in an age where lions and bears, wolves and wild dogs are a real threat. But it still reflects the tragedy of the fall. King Noah will have to butcher and kill his own animal subjects in order to stay alive. In the face of all this tragedy, be wowed at the incredible promise God makes. And this time in verses 9 and 11 repeats so that man can hear it. God could have just decided to not send another flood and kept it to himself. Why did he feel like he needed to tell man? But here he makes a covenantal, binding promise to never again destroy the earth. Noah has no say in it. This isn't negotiated. God just makes this promise. A promise that, while it might be primarily directed to, and in a way mediated through Noah, is a promise that God makes to the whole earth. Every man, woman and child descended from Noah, every animal descended from the survivors on the ark. This is a promise that God makes to the creation. This is a promise under which every one of us lives, and in which we can trust. That's the promise. It's unilateral on God's part. This isn't a treaty between equals. God speaks, and it is, and it forever will be. But that doesn't mean that there aren't stipulations. Every covenant in the Bible, whether it's between men and women, between God and man, whether conditional or unconditional, contingent or otherwise, every one of them has terms, stipulations. Since God is doing this, what is expected of man? When you get a new job, you get a contract, don't you, usually. Now imagine some wildly generous benefactor just offers you a job out of the blue. It's a dream job. It's got great pay, the benefits are incredible, you know, you've got dental care, private health care, life insurance, extensive holidays, everything you could ever dream of. And then they bring out the contract. Now it turns out that pay isn't related to performance. So you're securely salaried, however good or bad you are at the job. But there are specific stipulations about how you, as an employee, are to behave, what you're to do, what you're not to do. That contract should tell you just what kind of laziness or bad behaviour is going to get you called into the boss's office for a stern talking to. Now here, the terms of the contract that God makes between himself and all of us who are under this contract, it's given in verses 4 to 7. Now, if you're not happy with these terms, let me say this. This contract could only be drawn up by God, because God created man in the first place and then preserved him through the flood. God is completely within his rights to hold us to this, because the alternative, if you reject it, the alternative is being drowned and dead. So you either live according to it or you face the judgment of God. Now, like we saw before, what are these terms? Man is given permission to eat meat. We don't really know if he was doing that before the flood or not, but now at least he's given permission. But he's told that he's not allowed to eat meat with the blood still in it. Now, what are we to make of this? Is this a universal ban on black pudding? Some of you have heard that before. Some of you probably will be very happy if it was. And some of us will be disappointed that our Sunday supper just got a lot less delicious. But look at the context of this stipulation regarding animal and human life. Now, in the ancient world, and I'm sure in many cultures today, blood was understood to be the life force of every living creature. It's not surprising, is it? You know, you go to a doctor's, they check your pulse, your blood pressure, they do tests to make sure that there's no disease or anything. It's all in the blood. And so many ancient peoples, probably, again, many peoples around the world today, would bleed out animals when they butchered them as a sign that they appreciated that the life of the animal they were about to eat came from God as a gift, not as an entitlement. It's the same way that we say grace before a meal, to say, I know I don't deserve this, but it's from you, Lord, and I thank you for it. So what God is saying here is therefore basically, you can eat meat, but remember who it was who gave you permission. He demands an accounting. If you're just going to start upping and killing animals for the sheer fun of it, as if they were yours, you'll have to answer to him. They don't belong to you. Don't carry on as if they did. But this permission to kill and eat starts and ends with animals. God, who owned humanity by right of creation, further demonstrated that ownership by bringing them through the flood, as if he's bought mankind. That means that every human life, a life which, by the way, as we read in verse 6, is in his image and therefore categorically different to all the animals. Every human life belongs to God and not to humans themselves. No one, properly speaking, has the right to take a human life, even their own, apart from God. If man wants to live happily, if he wants to be blessed in the reset earth God has put him in, he ought to live according to these stipulations. He can't carry on with the violence that existed before the flood. He'll destroy himself. Three times, did you notice that, in verse 5, God states that he will demand an accounting for the shedding of human blood. Tolerance of murder in a society will corrupt and rot it from the inside out. There is no created thing as important as a human being. Something valuable enough that it was the first thing that God made sure was on the ark. Well, thirdly, having seen these stipulations or terms of the covenant, God, as he does with every biblical covenant, gives a sign. So that's our third heading, sign. Think of a few examples. When God, you know, that's later on in Genesis, in chapter 17, when God makes his covenant with Abraham, he gives circumcision as a sign. It's the same with Israel at Sinai. They're given the Sabbath as a sign. Now we've got the Lord's Supper tonight. When God established the new covenant through Jesus, he gave us the Lord's Supper. And we could perhaps talk about baptism as well. Now, often the sign is something that already exists. You know, circumcision existed in Egypt and in lots of other cultures before Abraham was given the sign. The Sabbath existed before Sinai. It existed from the seventh day of creation, didn't it? And the Lord's Supper was just a Passover meal. So it can be something that already exists but is given a new meaning, a new significance by the covenant, by the arrangement that is made. Now this sign is always given to be a reminder of the arrangement that exists between the two parties. Think again of some of the purely human covenants in the Old Testament, when Abraham or Jacob, if you want to just stick to Genesis, make treaties with the local rulers, and they raise a pile of stones as a sign. If they're grazing their sheep or their goats or whatever on the edges of their territory, they'd see that pile of stones and remember, we've made a covenant. I've got to keep my sheep on this edge of that border. Or maybe they'd be riding out to do battle against some of the local people. And then they see that pile of stones and they think, we made a covenant. This conflict, legitimate or not, needs to be handled differently. We can't just go killing each other. We've got an arrangement in place. Well, the sign that God gives for the covenant mediated through Noah is a sign, the rainbow. I don't know if there's enough sun peeking through. We might see one at some point today. But every time you see a rainbow in the sky, it's a confirmation of God's promise to not wipe out all life on earth ever again. It's an emblem of grace, as the old hymn says. A sign that despite the sinfulness of man's heart, God has shown his mercy to all creation in permitting it to continue year after year, season after season, day after day. But there's something particularly interesting about this sign. I'm not talking about the way it's been misappropriated in recent years. I want you to look at verses 12 to 17 and just see if you can see for whom this sign is given. Just give you a moment or two to look through those. Not once is the rainbow referred as a sign to the earth. Not once are we told that it's a sign for us. So it's not like we're going around murdering each other and ripping and eating the flesh from still living animals, see a rainbow in the sky and suddenly think, oops, you know, I'm not supposed to be doing this. Every time this sign is mentioned in these verses, it's as a sign for God. Whenever the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will remember the covenant. Whenever the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will see it and remember. Now hopefully you'll recall from last week that remember here doesn't mean that God has a chance of forgetting. It means to bring to mind the terms of an existing arrangement. Now, why would God need a sign to remind him of the covenant? He knows everything. He can't forget anything. Why would God need something to stop him from sending another flood, from wiping out all life on the earth? Well, it's because of the sinfulness of man and all the good reasons God has for killing us. Think of how pitifully we as a race have adhered to the stipulations of this covenant. I mean, you think of all the rules in the Bible, and we break pretty much every single one. If we just forget all those for a moment, just these terms and how we've broken them in every imaginable way. Is ever there been a society as soaked in blood as ours? Has ever there been a society as contemptuous of the image of God. Even the Egyptians who enslaved the Israelites valued the lives of their children. The 20th century was a murderous century. But 20 years into the next, we've already beaten it silly. We preach on the evils of eating meat and wearing leather shoes. And I was thinking about this last night. This time today, I've already done both of those things. And yet we murder children by the billions. Millions, at least. Our cheap clothes and electronics are made by slaves. We provoke God to anger every day. And that anger should be the death of us. But God put a sign in the sky to remind himself of his commitment to not treat us as our sins deserve or repay us according to our iniquities, as Psalm 103 tells us. The rainbow is like that pile of stones on the borders of Abraham's territory. When God has cause to ride out in battle to destroy us, he will see the sign and remember his covenant. Let me say a word for those of you who don't just fear God, but are actually frightened of him. To those of you so aware of your disobedience against God, so alert to the danger you are in if God were to call you to account today. To those of you who worry that God is like a rabid dog or an abusive father who might lash out in anger at the drop of a hat. He has put a sign in the sky to remind himself of his own promise. The rainbow is a sign to us of the merciful, loving, compassionate character of God. It says who he is, what he has done, and what he will do for sinners like us. I've mentioned this to some of you before, but the Hebrew word for rainbow is just the word for bow, as in bow and arrow, you know, war bow. We can make much of the fact that it shows God's commitment to peace on earth, that he hung his weapon in the sky. But there's a deeper significance there that every one of us who is a Christian ought to grasp. After the flood, we might be horrified at the thought of what our sins have earned for us in the sight of God. We should, if we're being honest, see ourselves as the kind of person who could not earn a ticket onto the ark. We could describe ourselves as anything but righteous. And yet here, in the first book in the Bible, we have another sign that God will deal with the sins of his people with his own hand. He's not going to leave man to sort it out himself. He's going to sort it. He saves Noah. He makes the covenant. He puts a sign in the sky, an enormous weapon pointed into heaven like a loaded gun. Sin needs to be dealt with, but the rainbow is a sign of how it will be. The rainbow to us is a sign of how it has been. For the people he loves, there is no price which God is not willing to pay.